Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Playing your favorite songs here. It's Toby Keith from the album. 35 biggest hits on KMAC, your 50,000 watt country music mother of the valley. Actually, this is my go-to karaoke song. And since we talk karaoke, every time Grant Newsham's on, I figured that would be appropriate. So, Grant, yeah, read it and weep. I would crush you in karaoke if I sang this anywhere in the Pacific Rim. Just so you know.
I'll take you up on that one.
All right. Now, this happened after we get off the air last week. Mac, hello. As usual, I forgot an interesting topic. I've been paying attention recently and doing some research on the Republic of Korea. The particular issue is President Moon trying to turn the country into a one-party state, then link it to North Korea and China and get the Yankees off the peninsula. So, first of all, how in God's name could you forget that? I mean, it's not like, when I go to Home Depot, sometimes I like forget one item that I meant to buy. Okay. And so how do you forget like something like that huge?
I do all the time.
You do?
I think the Frenchies call it something like staircase brilliance, where as you're walking out of the party on the staircase down out, you remember all the things you should have said. And so I've got that like Olympic level capability there. But I did forget, I did remember it at least 30 seconds afterwards. But it is an interesting topic.
All right, so let's talk about it. You tell me about your research, and because we're Korea, and again, when you look at the security of, dare I say, and I saw General Dunford talking about this, saying that he doesn't comment about, politics or things that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but he said, look, I am and I will be involved with, issues and organizations that concern themselves with the preservation of the rules-based world that got set up post-World War II. And, I kind of alluded to this last week. And so when you see Mr. Duterte, right, free himself from his American orbit of, historical Philippine orbit of the United States and migrate towards China, that compromises it a little bit. Were South Korea to do the same thing, it would be a huge win. And we talked about, the win for the United States in Palau, with Palau offering basing rights as the United States and China compete in the Pacific. Where does this come from, that the enterprising capitalist people of South Korea, I was stunned to read your email, to be honest with you.
Well, that's typical. I'm not saying it in a mean way, because so many of us, we have an image of South Korea, as great friends, tied together in blood of the Korean War, when the Americans came and saved them and the South Koreans fought, like tigers on their own behalf. And we've, had this, we believe, strong relationship to protect South Korea from North Korea. And we've watched and helped South Korea turn into a democracy that has elections and, power changes hands. It's a capitalist economy. It's like us, sort of. And, there's tons of Koreans who live in America, do very well. And a lot of us, particularly in the military, we've done team spirit exercises or what the various exercises and you know, you'll hear people say, well, I knew such and so, so-and-so Korean officers at command and staff or amphibious warfare school. And we have this sense that they're just thoroughly, you know, just tied to us because of our background. And in cases like, well, people like our age, it's because of our experience as well, that that we don't, it doesn't even cross anyone's mind that South Korea could drift away, and not just drift, it could actually paddle itself away into China's orbit and, you know, link up with North Korea and at that point, you know, be rid of the Americans. And you say, well, how could that happen?
Yeah.
And,
come on.
You know, but consider that, like, in any society, you've got different, there's different peoples with different opinions, and there's always been an extreme leftist movement, a leftist group in South Korea that, you know, got its start taking on the, when the military governments ran the place until the late 80s, you know, trying to subvert them and spying on North Korea's behalf. But these groups were very anti-American, pro-North Korea, and they sort of emerged out of the student movement, you know, going back probably, I would guess, for, say, 40 years or so. And they've always had, like, the remnants of these people still around trying to get their, you know, their objectives. They just weren't able to do it. But this is, so you've always had people in the South Korean political world, the society, the government even, who have had this as their objective, is to get the Americans off the peninsula. The Americans are seen as the problem that keeps Korea from being unified. And these people genuinely are sort of pro-communism or pro-China and pro-Juche, that North Korean ideology. And they, you know, are at that end of the spectrum. And yet we've tended to ignore them because our overall impression of Korea, South Korea, is sort of the positive, closely tied to us one. And this latest, and they've had, this is about the third leftist regime they've had since real democracy was put in. And this one with President Moon is, I think you have got really a coterie of hardcore leftists who are bent on the objective that I just laid out. And they have done a good job, actually, of getting control of the main sort of levers of power in Korean society, in Korean government. And it's something it's happened kind of, not, I wouldn't say it's happened quietly. It's just nobody's bothered to really make anything of it. And it reminds you a little bit, if you remember Turkey, when Erdogan, the president, took over some time back in an election, that, you know, there were people warning that this guy is an extreme Islamist, and he's not a Democrat, and he's going to get sort of one party rule forever as soon as he can. And it's taken him a lot of time, but he's just about done it. And yet you had the same sort of impression of Turkey that I just described about South Korea, because it was an ally, fought in the Korean War, NATO member. They're tough. You know, we had, you know, I dealt with Turkish officers at command and staff, et cetera, et cetera. And people would explain away the threat that Erdogan posed as saying, oh, he's just a religious guy, but he's a Democrat and a capitalist, and he's not going to do anything strange. And yet he has.
And at the end of the day, Turkey's going nowhere, right? That's how that conversation goes.
That's kind of it, you know. And you look at it now, and my goodness, you know, you almost wonder, you know, if they're not an outright enemy. And yet, you know, this happened despite, I would say, the majority of Turkish people not, if you'd said on day one, this is what Erdogan wants to go, most of them would have said, no, we don't want that.
Right.
A lot of them would have, but I'd say a majority would not have. And yet this wasn't able to be, it wasn't stopped. And I think something like this has been underway in South Korea for a while. And, you know, I think it's coming to a point where I don't see it, we ignore it at our risk, to my way of thinking. And it's something that I just had occasion to look into in some depth, and particularly sparked by allegations that their recent legislative elections in April 2020 were in fact rigged. which is always a sort of an alarming kind of charge. And so I just thought I'd take a look into it. I've looked at rather deeply, talked to a lot of people, and I sort of come to the conclusion that the elections probably were rigged. It gave Moon's administration just an overwhelming victory so that they can pass any legislation they want. And also, if they can just get three more votes from somewhere, and that's never hard, they can revise the Constitution. So this is one more lever of power that these hardcore leftists have gotten. And if you play it out, if the trend continues, and sometimes trends continue, sometimes they don't, but it does not bode well for American and, I'd say, free world interests in Northeast Asia.
So we've talked about, you know, Mr. Moon seems to be shocked when, you know, when he is rebuffed by the North, and that, you know, his charm and peace offensive and all the nice talk and all that often is met, you know, with the back of the hand from Mr. Kim. Yet he's undeterred. So his vision would be, how do the Koreas reunify? I mean, in their narrative, how does that happen?
Well, there are a common destiny, a common brotherhood of Koreans, and there's no reason they should not be unified, other than the American colonialists, literally, as how they're viewed, being on the peninsula, and keeping the Korean brotherhood split, and the Japanese are considered the front men for the Americans. It's been a little hard. You know, Moon his efforts have not been reciprocated by Kim, which isn't surprising. Yes. Kim doesn't have much interest in giving up power. He doesn't mind unifying, but on his terms.
Yeah, so he would be the king of the entire peninsula. And so to me, I have a friend, and I steal one of his great quotes, and that is, it doesn't survive the second question. So how have they convinced people that this narrative, and I want to get to the part where, you know, you to me, one of the most sobering things that you wrote was about getting to one political party. So how do they get past, you know, questions of, yeah, you know, it would be great to unify, you know, but clearly we're not going to do that under Mr. Kim. And so therefore it will never happen, at least in his lifetime, you know, and God only knows what comes after that. So where does the discussion go at that point?
Well, the idea that it's impossible to unify is one that we would say is, you know, that's how it looks to us. But from Moon's perspective and his people's, you just keep trying, and you keep, you know, making the offer. You keep, as I say, you keep pushing. And, you know, one thing, you do things that Kim, you know, tried, just like America used to do. You do things Kim might like. For example, Moon has really started cracking down on these Korean groups that help North Korean refugees, these groups that send, say, propaganda balloons into North Korea. South Korean government has just made life miserable for these people as a way to sort of placate Kim, the North Koreans. And really, it's about as anti-democratic, anti-human rights behaviors you'll find, and yet that's what they're doing. So we may think it's impossible to cut a deal with Kim, but if you're in Moon's position and you are favorably disposed to both him, or at least in the North and its ideology, well, you keep trying. It seems reasonable. It seems like something you can get if you pay the price. You know, I think the first of the leftist governments they had in Korea, they actually quietly paid $500 million to North Korea for the privilege of having a meeting. And this was kept secret, of course, but it was eventually revealed. And you do find this, as I noted, within South Korean society, there is a substantial constituency for what we would call the left, and that, you know, does generally agree with Moon. Some of them completely agree, some generally agree, and that you need to keep that in mind. But you do have a very aggressive, organized, in some respects ruthless, bunch of committed leftists at the top of South Korean government now. And, you know, given, to say, our comparison, you know, you say if Bernie, it was nothing but Bernie bros running the U.S. government, most people may not agree with that, but a lot of them would. And with the, when you're sitting in the seat of power, you can cause, you can cause trouble to your, for your enemies. You can suppress them, and so you can dominate the things that, that you need to control a society, such as the media, the intelligence services, the judiciary, the, in Korea's case, the National Election Commission. You can even make it clear to the military that they had better not cause you any trouble as well, which Moon's guys did a few years ago. They arrested a four-star general on really trumped-up corruption and abuse of power charges. He was eventually found not guilty, but at the same time, that sent a message to the military as well. And you've got the labor unions on your side. Academia, of course, is always, they're always nutty leftists. And with all of that, if you think about it, you have those, you know, if you, that control or extreme influence over those sort of levers of power, you can pretty much shut down your opposition. And the last thing, one of the last things they needed was the legislature, the National Assembly.
Got it.
And with this latest election that gave them just miraculously overwhelming victory, you got that. And so your opposition is cowed. They weren't very impressive to start with, but nonetheless, they were opposition. And you know, you've just about got all of the tools that, that you need. So if you have another election, it's, you're going to win. And it's this one party, so one party rule permanently. Some Koreans describe it as Moon's objective as not just quasi, not authoritarian, but quasi-totalitarian. And so that's the sort of the context of things there. And it's, once again, it's not a done deal yet, but it has gotten pretty far down the road. And the, you know, for, and I can't imagine the U.S. government doesn't know this, but the, I guess the question is, what do you do about it? And it is, I think it's extremely serious, and it, it, you know, would be nice to think we have our best brains on it. The election rigging charges in particular are interesting, because not least because we've got an election coming up, and in some ways, given, especially given the allegations of Chinese involvement in it, which I think probably are accurate enough. I think that those, you know, that it is something that, that we ought to pay special care to, or attention to.
So I just saw that they won 180 of 300 seats in their, in which house would have that been, or would that have been total seats, both House and Senate or whatever?
So, yeah, they just have a National Assembly.
Got it.
So it's, but yeah, that, and this was just, it was a huge, huge surprise to just about everyone. And, you know, as I say, even when I, you know, I follow Korea, of course, and I was surprised. But, you know, then again, you know, you think about it and, you know, consider the, you know, that famous picture of Harry Truman holding up that newspaper.
Yes.
That says Dewey beats Truman.
Right.
You know, these things happen, you know, in democracies and with the, you know, and, you know, even democracies, not just like Belarusia or Saddam Hussein's Iraq, but, you know, they do happen. These surprising, overwhelming victories. Mr. Trump's victory in 2016 was equally brain-rattling for many people.
Oh, my God. Are
but,
you kidding me?
You know, though, of course, it was charged. It was rigged, but that has been proven not to be the case, of course. But the point is, you get, sometimes elections turn out the ways you don't expect. But, say, I've, had occasion to look into it. And so I went into this sort of a skeptic, thinking, well, there probably isn't anything there. It's just as what happened. And but the, having looked into it, you know, I think that there certainly is something to the charges.
So you begin to go down this road, and I've had I enjoy doing this kind of research. I started the last time I had a major epiphany, and it was the work I do in the area of post-traumatic life. And I was told that, you know, the guys who came home from the Hennepin Hilton had a 4% rate of PTSD, and everybody else in Vietnam had, I think people of your educational class would call it Vietnam writ large. Is that how you say it?
Well, yes, we'd say it writ large. Yes.
There you go.
Yeah, that's how we would say it.
Vietnam writ large, whatever that means, has a 30% rate of PTSD. Now, okay, so you're telling me the guys that were kept in solitary confinement for years, and I love this clip from John McCain when he says, you know, the last 2 years we were together, and he talks about the last 2 years. He says, it's not like I just walked out of 3 years of solitary confinement, you know, that day. It's like, wait a minute, you were in solitary confinement for 3 years and you're ever going to be right in the head, right? But that group had a 4% rate of PTSD, everybody else 30. And I heard that and I said, there's no way that could be true. And then you go down, you know, the bumpy road of intellectual discovery and you find out, holy smokes, like you start seeing, you know, all these data points. Yes, yes, this. So you hear this. You're skeptical. What causes this to break squelch for you?
It was one of the things that I had occasion to sort of speak or talk about this with the Koreans who have raised a number of the Koreans who've raised the issue. And the first thing is I had sort of thought, you know, if I ever talked to any Koreans, it's going to be like going to a UFO convention or, you know, where an Area 51 sort of, you know, place where everyone's convinced, well, if you can't go into Area 51, it's proof that, you know, Martians exist. And, you know, I thought it might be that kind of nutty sort of conspiracy theory sort of thinking. But you talk to the people who've raised it, and they've raised it in the face of considerable opposition in South Korea. By the government in particular, and even the opposition party, which I can explain later, has not been all that helpful. But you talk to them, and these are level-headed people, you know, who make their case, and they don't, I would say, go too far. You know, they stick with the evidence they know, the observations they've made, and it also in a number of these are respected people. It's a mix of professors, lawyers, you've got statisticians, computer programmers, data analysts, software, semiconductor engineers, politicians, journalists, a lot of regular citizens. And there's one guy who even spent time, he's a former leftist and spent time on the run from the old military regimes. And he's very familiar with Moon and that crowd. But they were very normal people, say, who were just sticking to the evidence and the facts. And then you look at the evidence, and that's when you start to look at what the allegations are and see what they have. And it makes sense. You know, I have not seen a smoking gun, but there never is an election rigging ever. It's or in a lot of the investigations, but certainly in terms of a preponderance of evidence, you know, is it more likely it happened than not? Yes, would be my thinking. But when you looked at the evidence, looked at the chart, the allegations and the evidence to back it up, you figured, you know, I concluded that it at least warrants a substantial investigation by interested parties, and particularly given that the context in which it happens, where we are in the middle or potentially seeing South Korea slide out of our alliance and into an alliance with the PRC. But in the specific charges, and this is where it's kind of interesting, is that that is that fundamentally the election was digitally rigged, basically using high tech, cyber methods. And they particularly, the way it works in Korea is
now we hear that in America all the time, and it's most of the time debunked. So why? What did you read that? I know you were getting there, and I interrupted you, but
this is better than me lecturing. Yes.
So you read this, blah blah blah, and then something though obviously got your. Caught your interest. What was it?
You've got the way there the South Korean voting system works is you have it's basically, putting it simply, you have a main server at the National Election Commission.
Uh-oh.
And this connects to all of the the counting machines, or ballot sorting counting machines at each of the polling sites. So it's not like us where we have 3,000 plus counties, each of which do their own thing. But rather, you kind of have a centralized system in South Korea. So that gets your interest in terms of how feasible is it to get the manipulation right. And then these experts have gotten enough of a look at the machines to suggest that these can be hacked, manipulated, or that they can be accessed remotely. Some of the components in the machines apparently are made by Huawei, the Chinese.
Oh, shit. Say no more.
And that is such a black company in terms of being an arm of the Chinese Communist Party surveillance apparatus that alone just gets your attention. And these say there's been some guys, experts who've got a look, were able to get a look at these things, and they described what I just described. There's a video that exists of one of the machines counting ballots, and you have blank ballots being counted as votes for Moon's party, and ballots for the opposition are also being counted as votes for Moon's party. Another anecdote where one election site, a poll watcher, realized that the count was coming out. It was impossible because the Moon Party candidate was so widely hated in the district that they somehow were able to force them to stop the machine, turn it off, and restart it. And when they did, the vote was reversed in the the opposition party candidate's favor. So that sort of anecdote gets your attention. But once again, it was experts who've gotten a look at this, and they've gotten some evidence. It gets your attention. And then you move on, and the National Election Commission, which is maybe like, I don't know what we'd call it, maybe like our Federal Election Commission, but yep. with a little more immediate control over actually the running of elections. Once again, the central server. Guess who makes the firewalls?
Oh my, Huawei.
Once again, it raises an eyebrow. One of the guys, this most senior guys at the National Election Commission, is in fact was actually jailed 30 years ago for spying for North Korea. He's one of Moon's closest friends. So then you put this together. And then you have QR codes that are put on certain ballots. And a QR code is, as the experts will say, is very easy to manipulate, hard to detect the manipulation. And as I think in the state of Colorado, that they refuse to use these things because for those very reasons. So the QR code's another point of vulnerability. So if you look at it, as I say, from sort of the terms of a cyber operation, if you've got if you have access, if you have a network that you can get into, if you have some local cooperation, and you have the technical expertise to effectively sort of allocate votes to districts where you're going to you know, whereas it's a close race so that you win them, you know, you kind of think that, you know, maybe. I can't prove it. But at the same time, you know, if it was from looking at it from our perspective, if we were trying to do this to somebody, well, it's kind of not all that hard. And then you have these other things that I saw, which, you know, counterfeit ballots. You've got photos and videos that exist of, you know, these bundles of just brand new, crisp, unfolded ballots marked for the Democratic Party. You know, you have the huge chain of custody problems, you know, in terms of, you know, how the ballots, the physical ballots were actually handled, you know, in terms of irregular boxes with holes in them. They're not, the sealing tape's not working. And in terms of moving boxes around, the votes around, this one South Korean lawyer looked at the delivery logs of the delivery service, which moved the early and the mail-in votes. And if you compare through the time distance, it's simply physically impossible to go certain distances in the time claimed. And then you have these routes which crisscross South Korea to deliver a ballot that should just go a few miles away. So that too raises concerns. And then there's another thing that really got, you know, a lot of the just concerned citizens sort of worried, was that the statistically improbable voting patterns, you know, and basically what this is, before I get to that, but a couple of the guys that I talked to that raised this, one of them was the former president of what amounts to South Korea's MIT. And he's a real statistics expert, not surprisingly. And he, in fact, actually tried to disprove the suspicions of vote rigging, and said, look, it was the statistics voting patterns were very either artistic or if God didn't do it, it was rigged. And you have another expert who's an Ivy League PhD in the relevant subject, described the statistical voting patterns as throwing a stone 1,000 times and hitting the target each time. So, you know, when those kind of people say something like that, it gets your attention. And this is a little, I don't want to go into too much detail, but the Korean system, it allows for something called early voting, which means that for 2 days, about 4 and 5 days before election day, voters can go vote at polling sites, you know, if they want to just get it done early. And the so that you go and vote, and you put your vote into the box, and what happened with the results is that there was this really strange symmetry, is that for early votes, the Democratic Party, which is Moon's party, they got like 12% more than they did on election day. The main opposition party got 12% less than they did on election day. And normally the difference between early voting and election day should be about 2 or 3%. Then you have, you know, 40, you know, and these election, when they started counting, and the election day votes just kept coming in to consistently tip close races in the favor of Moon's candidates. So you had 40 districts where the Moon's candidates got 20 to 30% more early votes than their opponents. And it just came just down to the wire. It was just enough to tip all of those elections. That kind of gets your attention. And I had spoke with one guy who's a real math expert. He claims to have discovered the algorithm that was used to do what he calls digital gerrymandering, effectively allocate votes with real-time digital manipulation, and you move them into districts where you're going to need some extra votes to tip the election. So adding to all of this, there's even a University of Michigan professor whose his thing is election fraud. And He's not a Korea guy. I don't think he knows anything much about Korea, but you know, he's been doing this for years, and he does the statistical analysis. He looked at the results of the Korean election, and he reckons that so 7 to 7.5% of the votes were what he calls frauds. You know, it could be there's some reason why you have these weird votes, but he says that of all the elections he's looked at, this one's in the top 10%. But so, you know, you put all this together, and once again, there's nothing by itself that makes the case, but, you know, it ought to raise some suspicions, you know, and if something like this happened in our system, I, you know, wish people would get worried about it. To really assess these charges, particularly the sort of the computer hacking angle and the statistical results, you really do need some expertise. You know, that's not something I could do or really most laymen could do, but, you know, there's experts who do that stuff. And importantly, the people who have made the charges, they have presented their evidence. They're willing to present it and explain it, put it up for a challenge or confirmation. They're not hiding it. You know, they'll show their work if anyone's interested in it. And you know, there's a couple of other things. Like there was, you know, to throw in it the early voting sites. Apparently, the CCTVs, the surveillance cameras, were closed and were blocked off for, you know, to protect personal privacy. But on election day at the sites, they were not. So I suppose there's some need for less personal privacy during the early voting than afterwards. It's odd. You had at least 37 districts where there were more votes than voters. So for the total election, depending on who you talk to, there's like a million or two more votes than there are registered voters in Korea. Now that causes you some concern. Another gentleman did assess the number of people voting in specific locations and the speed it would have, according to the statistics, and the speed at which you would actually have to vote. And there was one place, and it's incredibly fast, and there's one place where during a one-hour period, people would have been casting votes every 1.7 seconds. So you say, you look at all, listen to all these things that I've said, and while they say there's no smoking gun, you'd think there would be some interest in looking into it. And this is where
certainly not among the, I mean, with that landslide win. And I just, here's a couple of headlines. As you've been talking, I was just doing kind of a news search headline from a publication called The Diplomat. South Korean politician adds China interference charge to election rigging claim. Ming Kyung-wook is claiming China helped rig the April parliamentary election. So that's one headline. Here's another one from the Korean Times. And the headline is, Democracy Can Be Hacked. And the story about QR codes, people that won on election night when, you know, the vote was tallied, and then when they added in, as Grant just kind of alluded to, when they added in the early voting and the other mail-in votes, which normally, right, break down along the same percentages as the people who cast their votes do. So normally when you go to a recount, you rarely see any change because the recount, you know, those votes split in close elections just about 50-50. So nothing really changes from election night. But in this case, right, the early voting skews to one way and then the mail-in voting skews to one way, which is what, you know, Grant's talking about. And you, I mean, when you do a search on this in relative to news stories, there is a ton being written about South Korea and about their last election. But I would think, given the control of the legislature by Moon's party, there will be no hearings. Nothing will be looked into. Yes?
Well, that's kind of it. You know, it's sort of what they've done is dismiss everything as fake news, conspiracy theory, etc. But there's an aspect, if you look at the behavior, the response to these charges, it comes across a bit like Sherlock Holmes' dog that didn't bark. You know, it's what the administration is not doing that is noteworthy, and I think warrants an inference. At least it may not be correct, but at least an inference that they're hiding something. When you consider that, these specific charges, particularly the technical manipulation, the counting machines, the hardware, the software, the QR codes, and also the statistical voting patterns. These are things which you can sort of easily address if you want to. Use your own experts to prove why the charges are false. Try to refute them. But they haven't done that at all. In fact, they've brought libel charges and sort of election interference charges against the people who've raised those claims. That fellow, the Min fellow that you quoted, is one of these guys. He's being charged as well, which is the one thing that doesn't really, give you much confidence in what's going on here. The Moon administration has used, they have gone after their critics sort of big time, even before the election. And this includes even like little one-man YouTube operations. They just go after them aggressively. And under Korean law, there's ways you can charge people with libel, even if it's true. You can also use the sort of the regulatory authority for public broadcast to shut them up. But the only real argument the Moon administration has made for the curious results is that, well, our voters went out to vote early. And the idea is, well, a lot of young people support Moon, and they all went out early. And yet the official statistics show that over half of the early voters were over 50 years old. And that's the group that votes conservative.
Right. So that tends not to be the liberal bloc.
So please explain. But they're just doing nothing other than saying fake news and going after the people who are challenging this. The judiciary, is really done nothing, although there's been something like 137 suits brought. And this is far and away more than have ever been brought after any election. The National Election Commission, you think that if somebody was charging you with, having run a fraudulent election, that you'd take it seriously and try to answer the charges, and yet they have not done anything particularly noteworthy to try to answer the specific charges. In fact, they've tried to shut people up. So that's not very good. One thing I would note, that this has not gotten much attention in the media, the South Korean media in particular. And there's some reasons for that. And one is that it's the subject's kind of complicated, to try and cover an election rigging suit or topic. Also, the fear of being attacked legally or otherwise harassed by the Moon administration. And in some cases, the media is actually pro or just sympathetic to the Moon administration. And you'll note that the administration is actually attacking sort of these independent journalists and so-called YouTubers who are trying to keep the issue alive. And so they attack them as just YouTubers, that dismissive term.
Right.
They're also targeting them and trying to silence them, which suggests, well, they might think they're onto something. But one of the curious issues to all of this is the main opposition party that got blown out. They were actually the first ones to say, we're not going to challenge the results. So you'd think, well, maybe there really is nothing there. But then you look into the main opposition party, and you also note that 25 losing candidates or unsuccessful candidates did file lawsuits. But also one observer has sort of described the opposition party as really opportunist, more than a sort of a principled, coherent conservative party. And they point out that really the top leaders in the opposition are actually considered very close to the Moon, to Moon's administration, Moon's party. And then there's other people in that the opposition that just don't want to go to the trouble of trying to overturn the election and then losing again. And then there's a lot of guys, people in the party who are just happy being in office, and they don't want to rock the boat. So it's not quite, you know, that point is not quite as solid as one would have thought, you know, in terms of dismissing the rigging allegations. And then, you know, as noted, you do have the charges of, well, before I get to that, the Chinese angle, but here's something that really is kind of odd, is that the Western myopia about all of the possibility of this, because Western media has not covered this really with any interest. You know, there are stories about South Korea. Even before the election, they tend to write about K-pop boy bands or actually sort of these pro-Moon pieces, but not about Moon's efforts to stick a stiletto into free speech and multi-party democracy. And they've, you know, their lack of interest really is something to behold, and it's disappointing. And also there's a sense that in both, I think, government and media that, you know, that an election rigging in South Korea or even anywhere isn't, you know, it's too hard to think about, you know, but say the South Korean case, you know, it's just a digitally rigged election, just hard to imagine. But consider how we're, like, every day we're told, you know, change your passwords, you know, protect your passwords, you know, update your antivirus software, be alert for phishing. You know, you'd think we were under computer attack, you know, and cyber attack constantly, which we probably are.
Right.
If the Chinese stole the entire U.S. government Office of Personnel Management database a few years ago, as one example. And, you know, this is a serious thing. And even the U.S. government has made some statements. Intelligence services have warned of Chinese interference in the upcoming election. But somehow when the idea of an election in South Korea being rigged is unthinkable.
Right. Right. You know, but again, this was the quote unquote Chicken Little scenario that was painted by, you know, people that said Huawei does not need to be part of the 5G infrastructure. And they got poo-pooed. And that's why, you know, when you and I talked, how stunning was it when the UK did an about face and says, yeah, we will give them, they will be out of our system in whatever, 18, 36 months, whatever the hell Boris Johnson gave them. But I mean, that is stunning. But that's what you get told, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you get told is, oh, you know, these things will happen. And then the response to that is, I mean, that's so poo-poo. That is so ridiculous. Right? I mean, such a thing is just ridiculous. It doesn't even deserve, you know, it does not even deserve to be commented on. And that's what that's what you get in return.
That's pretty much what it is. You know, so would like to think it'd be nice if maybe they have, and if so, I apologize, if the U.S. government would turn its smartest brains on it and just look into this, you know, and you know, the evidence is out there to be checked. You know, they ought to pay more attention and take it seriously. And also, if the media would do its job, that would be helpful as well. I found it a very interesting topic, and I reached a different conclusion than I expected at the beginning. And you know, in some ways, you might consider the Korean election sort of a warm up for elections elsewhere, including in our own, though the specifics will differ. And then again, there's that larger context in which this takes place, which is the potential that South Korea could no longer be our ally and really disrupt things in not just Northeast Asia, but all of Asia. And we're sort of watching that take place. And so that's why I thought it was a pretty interesting subject.
Right. Moving forward, one of the other stories that caught my eye was South Korea's conservatives outpolled Moon's party for the first time ever. Subheadline, public anger over housing prices has eroded support for Moon. Slipping support could make it hard to take on other issues. President Moon took office in 2017. This is the first time since then that the conservatives have outpolled him. What would you tell us to watch? What would you tell us the next important political event is for South Korea?
Well, that's a good question. Well, one thing to watch is that in the next few months that you will see if there is or isn't any movement in the Korean judiciary on the election charges. As noted, there's a lot of cases, suits that have been brought. And there's a time limit in which the courts have to act. And that time limit is coming up. If they do, we will see what they do. If they don't, well, that tells you something as well. So that's something, I say, to watch out. But what you just noted about the public unhappiness over housing prices in Seoul is evidence that I would suggest the majority of South Koreans don't want what Moon wants. But it's not as if he's being particularly obvious about his ultimate objectives. And so there is, if the conservatives or the opposition could actually get its act together, that there is something to work with in terms of arresting this slide. And sometimes if you can get get some exposure, say, to wrongdoing, say, efforts to manipulate an election, it makes it harder to do it a second time. And also it can create some sort of public unhappiness if they think they've been cheated, which would build support for an opposition. And that's where I think the sunlight that is exposed on One Moon's efforts towards sort of a one-party state and also the election itself, that would be a beneficial thing from our perspective. But it, once again, the media often plays a big role in that. But they've been missing in action so far. But so watch for the courts and watch for any domestic politics, because you do see that. My understanding is that housing price issue really is one that has got people worked up, and so much of the population lives in the Seoul area that it is a really big deal, and the economy is not in good shape. It hasn't been, and we'll see. It could be that. It's that something like that rather than Kim's efforts to turn South Korea into North Korea that get people's attention. Because it is the game's not over yet. There's still some time, especially given that I think a majority of Koreans would not go for what Moon is trying to do. We'll see. It'll play out. There's a lot of things going on now.
Let me read you an email. Mac, I have to say that when I first heard Grant talking about this, I found it a little bit not believable, which flies in the face of your conversations with him, which are always quite believable. In the course of listening, I find myself being extremely disturbed because I consider South Korea an ardent friend of ours, not certainly in lockstep with us all the time, but an ardent supporter of the post-World War II accords that you discussed earlier that have made South Korea the nation that it is today. I find it stunning that if they were able to use those QR codes to pull off this kind of fraud, that it would not be exposed. But I guess underestimating the low morals of politician is something politicians is something I've done most of my life. Interesting. underestimating the low morals of politicians. That's actually funny. But you could see they won. Why would we investigate?
Even the U.S., you know, when charges are raised, it's right. really hard yeah. for to get Department of Justice to go after them. You know, partly it's hard to make a winnable case as opposed to one where everyone knows they did it. But that's part of the reason. But also the caller noted that it's just hard to believe with South Korea, but. And also one thing that's always very interesting is that you look at the opinion polls in South Korea as to do people want the Americans still around. And often it's the very high support for the American presence in the population writ large. And is something that's in our favor. Because it's noted, I think most people would not want to end up where Moon wants to get them, but you know, if they don't know they're getting there, they're getting boiled slowly. But there is a lot of support for us, for our side. We have that to work with. It would be good if the Trump administration doesn't keep trying to ask for so much money from the South Koreans and also gives them a break trade-wise. But those are two things that we can easily fix.
Well, It's interesting, Grant, but you know the United States suffers from some of the same maladies, which are we are having a discussion in this country that is accepted as truth that in fact isn't true, and that is that police officers are hunting black men. If you go to any database, if you talk to anybody who's a serious critic of a serious observer and critic of police departments in the United States, even they will tell you, yeah, those numbers aren't what people are. Yet the constant discussion in the United States is that this is in fact the case. And so it's assumed, you see professional athletes, it's assumed that, you know, that that's what the police are doing, when in fact reality is something completely different. So in the United States, there's a similar thing going on. As you said, you know, the people by and large, the Korean people overwhelmingly, you know, want an American presence there. And I think identify with freedom, with the economic prosperity that Koreans have seen in their lifetime, which has been, you know, which has been amazing. And so yet there's this constant intellectual drumbeat in a different direction. And you see that here in our country as well, is that it's amazing the power of the liberal media to set an agenda. And I think if you don't say manipulate the agenda, you're being naive now. And I would have never said that years ago.
Kind of what's going on. If you don't do your homework, it's easy to let someone else tell you what to think. Relatively small group of committed, noisy, aggressive ideologues can do, even though it's, you know, doesn't have all that much public support, is always impressive. And as noted in the South Korean sort of society, there is a substantial, pro-leftist faction, so that shouldn't be ignored.
It shouldn't be surprising to anybody either. I don't know. To me, and again, I always struggle with my own, my own Boy Scout / choir. You know, has the truth ever mattered in journalism, or am I just? But I thought reporters were supposed to report the truth, and I'll just give you one of the most recent examples. And two sheriff deputies were ambushed in their vehicle in Los Angeles in the Compton area. They were municipal transit cops. They were, you know, they deal with the bus system. They deal with the trolley system in Los Angeles. They were sitting in their car, a marked car. A guy walks up to them. You've probably seen the video, and shoots them. They get taken to the hospital, and protesters arrive there you know, chanting, hope they die, let them die, things like that. And the Los Angeles Times, in their, and this happens early evening Sunday, in their Monday edition, doesn't even mention it.
No.
Exactly. I mean, which is, I mean, so a story happens and you don't report all the facts because those facts that your reporters might report, which reporters get paid to report, which is the function of reporters in a democracy, they fly in the face of this narrative that we're crafting on our op-ed page and our editorial pages. So we're not going to include that in the story. And it seems to me like there's so much more of that in the news today than anybody wants to admit. And that's what you're describing in South Korea, is that there's this bias against the United States and this pro-Chinese sentiment in their media, right, that belies and contradicts, you know, the Korean people. But that doesn't matter because it is this agenda of this limited group. And I don't know. The more I watch events in the United States, the more I think that, you know, what's being taught in our universities is a bunch of shit, right? The lack of critical thinking that goes on there is ought to concern most Americans, because a lot of the issues that we discuss, if you apply the does it withstand the second question, the answer is no. Yet young people who get their, you know, news from social media, they don't seem to be able to figure it out. And so who is it? You've corrected me before. The New York Times or the Washington Post, democracy dies in darkness or something like that. And it's an engineered darkness, which to me is most disturbing. And you're talking about the same thing now in South Korea. So
plus the South Korean government can use sort of the law, you know, will use the force of law to actually suppress its opposition in the media, which makes it even harder for them to do a job.
Right.
So it's even tougher there. The foreign media has less excuse.
All right. The next time you come on, can we get your impressions about the report that the DOD issued relative to China?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm curious because Chinese naval development has, by the Pentagon's admission, has outpaced even the most optimistic estimates that the Chinese had. And now that evidently, according to an article today, and that was based on comments made by the head of the U.S. Strategic Command, that the Chinese next objective is to improve their nuclear ballistic arsenal, and then that in tandem with space operations. And so I'd be curious about where you see all of that going. And then I have an email for you here before I let you go. Hey, Mac, before you let Grant go, could you ask him how actually brittle are Australian-Chinese relations? How does he see that thing being resolved? So how brittle, one, is it peanut brittle? Is it, give us some kind of visual analogy. Peanut brittle, is it, give us something. Is it bamboo brittle, which is not very brittle, bamboo pretty strong? How brittle is China, Australia, and where do you see that thing going?
I think it's brittle. You know, the sort of like a Snickers bar that's been put in the freezer for a while. But
that's brittle.
Yeah, it's the Australians have stood up and shown what you can do if you tell the Chinese no, and don't back down. And the question is whether or not Australia will continue that. And I think if it's the conservative government, I think they will. I'm not sure what the other side, Labor, would do if they should take over, they may be willing to accommodate China. But Australia has done a very good job of, from a few years ago, waking up and taking on China. And I think they're going to, stick with it, would be my guess. We'll see.
Do you see a path to some sort of reconciliation or a path towards some kind of middle ground for them? I don't see that, because I don't see the Australians backing down from this argument. And if they won't back down, the Chinese sure as hell aren't going to. They're going to continue to want to force the Chinese to play the emperor's new clothes. I mean, the Australians.
I think so. And that's one of the interesting things about the Australian position is that even if they really have a choice, there is no real middle ground. They either do exactly what the Chinese want them to do, and then that smooths over the relationship. And if they do that, they lose their sovereignty. But if they stand up, then they're going to, face the wrath of China, such as it is.
All right. One last question from an email. Mac, I was reading in many of these reports, they discuss a window for China relative to its demographics. Could Grant explain that to us? Yeah, you see that constantly in when you're reading about China, is their demographic problem. What does that mean?
It means that there's not enough children being born, partly because there's not enough women, and within 20 years or so, the population is going to plummet, and it's going to be a lot of older people and not enough younger people, and with all the problems that poses for a society, I think those tend to be overblown a little bit. So it's true as far as it goes, but it doesn't mean that, even with a lot less Chinese and with a lot less young people, that you still couldn't have a formidable military. Considering China has no enemies, that this military buildup they've done has got to be of real concern. But that's what it is. It's like an aging society with a shrinking population. How does it have the resources to, one, support its people, but also to do sort of military things? And China will face some challenges that in that regard within the next 20 years. And then if you see the math, their population drops off a cliff. But that doesn't mean that they still won't be able to cause people trouble. It's my way of looking at it.
Got it. But so the demographic, how did they run out of women?
For all those years from about 1980, roughly, when they had a one-child policy,
right,
until just a few years ago, that when people saw that they were going to have a daughter born, they would eliminate her. So you've got something like 30 million too many men who were never going to have no prospects of ever getting married. If you don't have enough women, your population isn't.
Why would they be prone to aborting a female? Why?
I forget the reason. It's a real simple one, that they like males more. Yeah. A guy can work, something like that.
No, I mean, in Afghanistan, when the Taliban went around to intimidate people, they would shoot or pour oil or hot water, boiling oil or water, on the girls as the first step, because the girls weren't worth as much, because the boys would work, the girls would simply be married off and go someplace else, but the boys would stay and work. And so in Afghan society, it was that way. I just wondered about Chinese society, what would cause them to do that?
I don't know the answer to that. But it's a simple one. I just don't know.
Got it. So all those years of that population control, are those population controls still in effect?
No, they took them off to some extent just a few years ago, but it's not like everyone is rushing to make up the shortfall.
Got it.
They've got a problem.
All right. So, well, first of all, we always appreciate you staying up late, Grant. And this discussion is disturbing for a couple of reasons. One, you know, I think we've all grown up, you know, with believing that South Korea was an ally. You know, Americans have spilled blood there and whatnot. And then, it's the same narrative, which is a media which now can't keep its own beliefs out of its own reporting and believes it has the right through their activism, right, to skew what comes to people based on their judgment. And that is a question that comes up more, an issue that comes up more and more in free democracies about activism spreading into what is supposed to be reporting and skews the entire issue. And oh, by the way, most of the people that are involved in that are liberal. And so I don't know. It seems to be not a very good trend. I would say, and it just seems like we encounter it all the time. So disturbing. All right, sir. Have a good night. Thank you very much for the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. Anytime.
All right, Grant. See you.
Right.
That is Grant Newsham from Taipei, I think. He sent that email right after we finished our interview last time, which is odd. And then I saw the subject matter and I was like, is that really a thing? And then as I read, I was like, whoa. So anyway, this whole issue of, you know, voter fraud is not a small issue. And I just, for the life of me, okay, let's put like normal people in a room and what do you have to do? You got to bring something that proves where you live, right? That proves that you're a citizen of the country. I mean, to me, that's fundamental. Oh, you can't do that because there's all these people that don't have any of that. Well, who are they? They don't have a driver's license? They don't have any form of identification? Oh, no, that's voter suppression. Well, then how do we have a free election? How do we have a fair election? And so if I rank my priorities as a guy who's running, you know, the Federal Election Commission, the first one is that we have a fair election. Fair is number one. Inside of fair, we want everybody to vote that can. So we're going to vote over the course of 48 hours. We're going to vote on a Saturday and a Sunday. It's going to be a national holiday, McNamara says. That's right. And you got to show up and you got to bring your ID. You got to be able to prove who you are. And then you vote on a piece of paper and we count that paper. We don't do it electronically, right? In case you haven't noticed, all things electronic are not good. Just read the comments section of any article. You know, read 5 comments down and you will see the dumbest shit you've ever seen in your life. Yeah. So anyway, but it keeps being an issue. So not surprisingly, I should say. All right, if you're just joining us in the first hour, in the first hour, we talk about post-traumatic winning goes to Home Depot and breaks out. I think I was on in aisle 10. Yeah. I talk about YouTube studio building and being almost done with the first section, and then we had a disaster. And I know my sons were laughing when they heard about it. They're like, yeah, we've been around for those. We've seen the mushroom cloud. We talk about the timeless beauty of the broom. Think about that. All these centuries later, the broom is still a thing. Pretty amazing. What else has had that kind of a run? The candle? The broom? What else? Name a few. Not too many. And then the ultimate outcome, everybody knows that what's called the Midas touch, right? Do you know how the tale of Midas ended? Well, don't touch that dial, and you can find out. And then, if you're just tuning in, Grant came on to talk to me about an email he sent after last time. He said, there's something I've been looking into that I think that would make for interesting conversation. So, yeah, election fraud, election manipulation in South Korea. Interesting. So, on this Tuesday, have a great day. All Marine Radio, over and out. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. Even if you are in Home Depot. And to the dude who left his dog in the car at Home Depot in Costa Mesa, in his Tesla, you're lucky. All I got to say is you're lucky. Have a great day. Go change somebody's life. Out.